This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done remarkable things for the sake of our freedom, and we don't want to take that for granted. The goal of this show is to, first of all, honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we understand and we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated, we're entertained, and even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I tell you, I'm pretty excited about our next episode. A 93-year-old who was a Marine on Guadalcanal, became an aerial gunner, then a decorated pilot with some close calls that you're going to have a hard time believing. But that's next time. And for today, you know, some of the most compelling stories we've heard on Hometown Heroes over the years have been from ex-prisoners of war. If anybody understands the value of freedom, it's those people who have been forced to live in captivity. And over the years, I've had the privilege of sitting down with ex-POWs all over the country, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Texas, Washington, New Mexico, all over California, you name it. And I thought, since this week marked National POW MIA Recognition Day, that's the third Friday of September every year, I thought it would make sense to hear from some ex-POWs today. We're going to hear from three different men who not only were taken prisoner, they all had to survive death marches. Two of them on the infamous Bataan Death March in the Philippines, the other on a march that isn't as well known but was certainly harrowing, the German Death March across Europe. They come from different backgrounds. One grew up not far from our southern border in New Mexico, another a Native American raised by his aunt in Kentucky, and the third a minister's son from California's Central Coast. We'll get just a taste of the kinds of things they endured, and if you're anything like me, by the time we're done, you're going to feel like some of the challenges you're facing pale in comparison with what they went through during World War II. We'll start with one of the first veterans to ever appear on Hometown Heroes way back in 2007. Wild Bill Begley is his name. Yeah, that's his real name, Wild Bill. And if you ever go to a ceremony at the VA in Fresno, you'll probably see him there in his wheelchair wearing his distinctive hat. He can't communicate as well as he used to, but if you see him salute the flag with that sincerity he has, it might make your eyes water like his do. Let's jump into his interview where he remembers arriving at Clark Field in the Philippines in November 1941 with the 34th Pursuit Squadron. He was a radar and radio operator, and he was expecting to find P-40 Warhawks to work with.
It was quite a shock when he got there. They just took us out in a field, and they said, "Here, this is what we got." They were worn-out P-35s that were originally slated to go to Sweden, and the Philippine Air Force had wore them out, and grass had gone up through the canopies and all through it and outside. That's what we got.
So you looked around thinking this was some kind of sick joke or something.
Yeah, well, they gave us 25 of them, and naturally they weren't flyable. But we had some good mechanics, and we cannibalized five of them. We got all of them going. And the next shock was, "Where's our airfield?" They took us out sugarcane field and says, "Here, cut the sugarcane." Well, we did. And then somebody says, "There's some tankers out there. I think there's molasses." Somebody said, "Well, let's try it on the runway because the dust was so thick." So they poured sugarcane molasses on the dust so they could see when they landed.
You'd been there less than 3 weeks when that date we all remember as December 7th, 1941 rolled around. But for you, it was December 8th because you were on the other side of the international dateline. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Word comes to you guys over the radio. You have these planes ready to go thanks to your mechanics, maybe a little underarmed with just two 30 caliber machine guns on each plane. But General MacArthur issued an order to ground all planes. And your pilots did not follow that order, did they?
Our squadron commander took it to heart, and he explained it to the 20 pilots that we had. And he said, "Look, man, I'm not going to sit on my butt and get what we have shot up. I'm going to take off. I'm not going to tell you to go because you'd be subject to court-martial." So he took off. He says, I'll do what I can to keep you out of trouble. They all took off. And then lo and behold, up above us, just as they were taking off, about 60 Japanese bombers and fighters appeared right over the aerodrome. But they took off anyhow. And it's a wonder they hadn't dropped down and got them. But they made it clear. I could hear the squadron commander say, "Look, men, we'll stay together in the group. If you get a good shot, take it. One of them gets on the other's tail, take him if you can." And that was it. The upshot of it was there's a lot of shooting and air acrobatics and up there, and when they landed, all of them were shot up pretty bad. We didn't lose any, but they shot down two Japanese planes, and the ground crew got two more, and then we looked out. We could see at least two more on fire. So they did a pretty good job. We didn't lose a single plane, although they were badly shot up.
And I can tell even now that the courage those pilots displayed still means something to you. They know they're facing court-martial just for taking off. Not only do they take off, they're outnumbered 3-1. Their planes aren't as fast or have as much firepower as the Japanese, yet all of them land and take out four Japanese planes in the process. So obviously a lot of courage on display that day. But you yourself would have to summon quite a lot of courage before the war was over. Not long after that, your supplies started to run out. The Americans were outnumbered on the Bataan Peninsula. And when they didn't have enough gas to fly the planes anymore, they gave you a bit of a surprise when they said, "You're in the infantry now." Had you had any kind of infantry training?
Believe it or not, I didn't. For basic training, I had practically nothing except the Articles of War and march and march and march. The pitiful thing about it, after we became infantry, they issued us one bandolier shell and said, don't shoot any of these unless you have to. The bad thing about it, all the rifles and stuff that we got were condemned. And I had, with the one I got, I'd pick it up and the bolt would flop. I put another one in there, and during the firing, it froze, and it was a bad situation. I couldn't fire it, and I couldn't eject the shell, but after it cooled, I made sure I fired slow.
I suppose so, if it's all rejected rifles from World War I that they've got you using out there, not to mention no infantry training, not to mention you're outnumbered, you didn't have any food. Can you give us an idea of the kinds of things that you had to resort to eating?
Well, we had a saying, if it moves, eat it. If it stands still, we salute it. We ate monkeys and snakes big, ugly lizards. Anything that walked, crawled, or flew, we ate. That was about it. The thing about it is we were starving, actually. We ran out of food, and right at the last, whenever General MacArthur sent word by General King for us to surrender, we didn't want to, none of us did, but that was the orders of the day. And we stacked up our rifles and went out to the road, and there's where the real terrible things happen.
That may be an understatement. When Bataan fell, the surrender of 78,000 American and Filipino troops to the Japanese was just the beginning of what was going to be 3.5 years of captivity for you. And I'm sure you had no idea how much you're going to have to go through, how much you'd have to survive. But do you remember what was going through your mind when you became a prisoner of war?
I was already in bad shape. As I said, I went from 180 pounds to about 110 approximately. And the reason is we didn't have any food. And like I said, if it moved, eat it. If it stood still, we always said salute it.
But once you're on the march, you don't even have the opportunity to do that. If you stop even to try to get a drink of water, you might get shot, bayoneted, even decapitated. You witnessed all of those things happen, didn't you?
Yes, unfortunately, I witnessed all of that kind of stuff. I walked approximately about 100 miles, I suppose. It was a terrible ordeal. On the march, I was on it about 10 days, approximately, and I didn't get any food, didn't get any water. Guys would drop out, and they'd try to help one another, and it was pitiful. If you stopped, they'd either shoot or bayonet you. They got so they seemed to enjoy bayoneting more than anything else. It was terrible. The thing about it is they also got some women and children, unfortunately, and they wouldn't let them out. They finally did. Quite a few of the Philippine soldiers, they slipped off into the forest, and if they got caught, they'd get shot, if they are bayoneted. So you had to be careful. The thing about it is they didn't have a whole bunch of guards there, but they had enough to where they could see from one guard to the other. We stopped at one place. I think it was the town of San Fernando, and they lectured us in Japanese. They had an interpreter that would tell us what he's saying. And they said you'd be shot and you'd be bayoneted. You had to do what they wanted to. And if you dared to get off the road, see a dirty ditch full of filthy water, a lot of guys would be desperate and they'd make a break for it. And they'd shoot them and bayonet them. You couldn't even get at that. It was pretty horrible. They'd pick out 10 men, make them dig a hole in the ground, and they would use their two-handed samurai sword, and they'd try to first see if they could decapitate a guy with one lick. They'd make you come to attention, and they'd walk away. Then later, they got tired of that because they got blood all over their uniforms and their equipment. So they decided to change it, and they lined us up about 10 again. You dig a hole, then they'd come around behind and shoot you in the back of the head. You'd fall in. That went on until they got tired, and then they had us take off. We walked day and night, no food, no water. It's a terrible ordeal. I remember in particular two incidents that still come to mind. There's a lady, we went through a little barrio, they call that a town. She had a little boy about 3 years old. He stuck his finger up and said, V for victory. When he did, a Japanese guard happened to be close by. And he bayoneted the little feller. And he raised him up, and he tried to fling him off his bayonet. And his mother screamed. She ran out there, and she tried to cover him. And the guard bayoneted her. And she died right there.
Unbelievable things that you witnessed. And I know some that you experienced yourself. You estimated you were bayoneted 30 different times. And after the march was over, you were still a prisoner of war another 3.5 years before you were liberated, wasting away to 68 pounds. That's less than 40% of your original weight. That is almost unfathomable. I'm sure there were days there where you thought you were going to die. So what kept you going? What allowed you to believe that you could survive and come back and get married and have a family and have the kind of life that you were fighting to preserve?
I didn't have no fancy thoughts about marrying or anything like that. I was worried whether or not I'd ever get through and survive. That was the main consideration. And under the circumstances, you wonder what made me keep going and whatnot. By then, they were giving us a bowl of watery rice once a day and get one canteen of water until they picked us up and sent us by ship to Mukden, Manchuria. There we got a little better consideration because they put us in the, most of it, in the tool and die factory where they made the tools for machinery or plane parts or anything. Everybody, 100% of us, sabotaged everything. And they had guards right over us, and we'd put filings in the oil and all kinds of stuff.
You spent a long time in Squaw Valley and more recently in Fresno, but I know one thing that you've done is traveled all over the state to serve on an honor guard participating in military funerals. Why was it so important for you to do that?
Well, when we got to O'Donnell, the first prisoner of war camp, the guys were dying so fast, and it was terrible. And they're in bad shape. The ones that were standing and able to walk and to carry somebody, we'd get a door off of a hut, and four of us get on it many times before we got to the hole in the ground where we'd have to throw them in there. Maybe half of the guys, and I've seen as many as four of the stretcher bearers, would die en route. Mm. It was pretty tough.
What an understatement. That is Wild Bill Begley, an interview recorded 7 years ago now. Time for a break, but when we come back, again, commemorating National POW MIA Recognition Day, we're going to hear from another survivor of the Bataan Death March, Hometown Heroes, right back after this.